Claire Keegan's eagerly awaited second collection of short stories, Walk the Blue Fields, has just been published. Her first collection of stories, the multi-award-winning Antarctica. Claire Keegan joined me in the 11th Hour studio earlier, and I begin by asking her whether she considers her new collection to be about a rural past we don't see anymore.
I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure that we've gone so far that we don't live like this anymore. I think people in the city may think we don't live like this anymore, and people in the country may not think we live like this anymore, but if you're not thinking about it, you can see it happens.
I find it interesting, like the story of the Forester's Daughter, about the motivations of the man getting married and keeping the family seat together and all that. There's still motivations in people's lives, aren't
there? Yes, of course. I think all of this is relevant to today. I find it really interesting that I'm criticised to some extent for writing something that's old-fashioned. But this book is concerned with, well, there's child abuse, there's a woman who wants to have a child without a man, there's alcoholism, there's marriage. I think there's
love, clergy, priest.
Yes, a priest falling in love.
Dogs, horses.
I think it comes out of the country I live in now.
The country hasn't changed all that much, really, has it?
No, it hasn't. We've more money. But I don't think our attitudes have changed drastically. Do you?
I don't.
No.
Their attitudes to wives or livestock or property hasn't changed.
Well, even if it's set in the 70s, most of the people I would be writing about are still alive. The people don't die off just because we've had an economic boom.
But are the structures of the country, the social structures and the economic structures and the sort of the romantic and love and relationship structures, have they not changed drastically in the last 10, 15 years?
Well, I'm probably the wrong woman to ask about love and romance, so I don't know.
Well, there is no love and romance in this book, no.
There is love and romance in the book. There will always be love and romance in every good book. I can't think of a good book without love. I think all good stories are to some extent about love and not really about romantic love, unless of course they're love stories. But the love of a child, the love of a field. I cannot think of any fine book which isn't about love and human loneliness. I also think that fine stories are deeply concerned with human loneliness, that's with something that is common to us all, that makes our circumstances difficult, that turns us upside down so that something falls out.
The book is dark. The themes are dark. They're not very joyous or positive, are they?
You see, I really disagree with that. because I think Night of the Quicken Trees is a story about two people who get exactly what they want. I think The Forester's Daughter, they're all together leaving that house in the end. They are not going to split.
In fairness, no, the house is burnt down. And
but that's only a house, and that's what Deegan says at the end. It is only a house. It is only the material thing, and it's been the thing that's been in the way of their marriage.
His obsession with his obsession with keeping the money together to own the house.
Yes, and when that is gone, I think the family finds a freedom at the end of that story they didn't have until then. So I find that a really positive thing, but I think that people sometimes confuse difficulty with darkness. But we all go through difficulty, and if there's no problem, there's no story. So every fine story is about a problem, and I think the difficulties I resolve for my characters in this book are resolved in a positive fashion. I think they're finer people at the end of the stories. I don't think they're diminished.
In that story, Forester's Daughter, the dog is very central to the story. Was it a kind of like an artistic risk to give the dog a voice?
It was an artistic risk, absolutely. I don't know anybody who can get away with it really well except for Liam O'Flaherty and Alistair MacLeod. I mean, Liam O'Flaherty is just wonderful when it comes to animals. And I did. I took a risk. The biggest risk I took in the book was with point of view. I change point. I have several points of view in that story. I split the point of view in Night of the Quicken Trees between Margaret and Steck, and I also split it in Surrender. And there, it's very difficult to do that in a short story. So even though they may seem like traditional stories, they're quite risky, as you say,
a radical
in
form,
an artistic
like.
Way. Yes.
But to follow that through a small bit, you find a story in your head, you get a shape on it, you write it, and then you apply the analysis and the technique to it. Is that what happens?
No, I don't find the story in my head. I don't think stories come out of your head. I think stories come out of your body. There's a writer called Robert Olin Butler who says that writing is not about ideas. Writing comes from the white hot center of you. So it's when you stop thinking that you start writing well. If you're thinking, you're probably writing badly. You have to be physical and go into the realm of sensation to write well. No, it's not conceptual. It's just burying yourself in the language and stumbling and grappling with language to find who your character is, for the sake of expressing something meaningful about humanity.
You mentioned that that you like, you were writing a book about Wexford, and you like to go and live in Wexford and get the sense of the language, the syntax, the rhythm. Is that where the story comes from? Is it from that rhythm or syntax of language?
I suppose I don't really know where the story comes from. I'm just interested in a person. And I suppose I have a background of, I mean, in my own personal life, of just being interested in people and what it is to be human and walk in the earth. And so I might just start with a sentence, or I might start with a walk and have a field, or have a chapel, or have a man living with a goat. And there's just something about that that won't go away. It's just, it resonates, and I know there's a story there. It's like an elbow. It's just like an elbow, you know, but when you straighten your arm, it disappears. and it's a very tricky business. But most of the time, I don't know what I'm doing. And I can't define it. And I don't want to, because if I think I could, I think if I could, it would go away.
You'd lose the magic. You'd be a fear of losing the ability.
Well, there's not much magic in it either.
It's hard work. It's slog.
It's not slug. It's a pleasure. It's what I do. And I love what I do. But it is work, yes.
But you do a lot of rewrites. You examine and question every word, every paragraph.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I make it the best I possibly can in that time. And I don't care who's in a hurry to get it. Because writing fast won't make me live longer. And I want to write as well as I possibly can over time. And I suppose I think that fiction is about how we cope with time. I suppose you could almost say that the art of fiction is the art of how we cope with the passage of time. So not to take enough time to do it well would be a travesty for me as an artist.
But when do you know you applied the last brushstroke? When do you know that?
You don't know it. They say no books are finished, they're abandoned. And at some point, you cannot do any more, given the time you have and given the story. And you have imagined it as well as you possibly can, for the sake of your character. And you do feel that you have done him or her justice.
So it's as good as it gets. Nothing's ever perfect. Is that how it works?
Yes.
Marriage, in your book of stories, marriage is not the beautiful, exalted institution of true love and happiness.
Where is it that?
In the books. Not in your book, mind you.
I did read some Mills and Boons growing up. But they didn't really fool me into thinking that that would be the case. I don't know what to say about marriage. I mean, I'm not married and I know very little about it, but it seems to be the thing to do, and I've often been, I suppose, really interested in why people marry, and what goes on under the roof. And every house is a different house. And nobody really knows what's going on in anybody else's mind. And I remember reading Shaw when I was an undergraduate living in New Orleans and thinking, you know, I think he said something about when two people are under the most misleading, exalted of passions, they swear they will remain in that state for the rest of their lives. And I remember thinking it funny, but somehow it coordinated with what I thought.
In the story, the forester's daughter, the woman, decides to get married because she's in her 30s and nobody else might ask. That's a bit far removed from Shaw, isn't it?
I don't know. I don't know that it is. I think it may be just Shaw turned on his head. And an inversion is always close to its original. I'm a good Heracletian in that sense. And I don't know. I think sometimes people just make a slice in their life because nothing is happening in it. So they cut into it to change it. And it's a risk. And I think we have the lives we risk. And we pay for the risks we take. And I think she paid for the risk.
It's amazing. I found that story extraordinarily sad. And now you've convinced me that's a very positive story.
But I think that a lot of the things that are sad in our lives are positive. I think when you're in pain, you're learning. And I think my stories may be like that.
The story Surrender, written inspired by McGahern.
The story was inspired by a line in McGahern's memoir, which said his father was said to have sat on a bench in Galway and eaten 24 oranges before he married. I heard him say this on the radio in an interview, and he said he thought it was an extraordinary thing to do. And I thought it was such a revealing act.
But this would be during the war when oranges were seriously scarce.
No, it would have happened in the 30s.
Even scarcer,
and I
probably.
Said, I'm not sure of
no,
that.
I'm not sure either. No, I'm not sure either.
I think they would have been scarce or at least only available on the black market in the 40s. Mm. So I chose to set the story in the 40s so he'd have to get them on the black market. I thought they would be sweeter.
Priests feature in your book of short stories. Are you making some comment on the church, or where does the priest fit in our society today?
Again, I don't know. I don't know, and I think the priest doesn't know either. I think we've changed. We're changing so quickly from a place where there was quite a stiff hierarchy of people, of the doctor, of the big farmer, of the priest. And I'm not old, and that was certainly true in the time when I was a teenager. So we're talking 20 years ago, that was true, to now where the aristocracy is kind of shattered and the priests have kind of disappeared from that pedestal of authority. And I was interested in this, in writing a story about how a priest would manage, again, with the passage of time, with how time changes and therefore with how his work would change over time. And I think it's a story about a man who's lost. And he just doesn't know how to be a priest.
Is there some, moral is the wrong word, is there some lesson for us in these stories about the way our society is shaped today? As you say, the structures are broken down and we don't. Is there some message for us?
No, it's not like that. I don't think of myself anyway as that kind of writer. The stories aren't meant to be didactic. I think if the stories are good, they will read you. There's no message, no particular message I have to send. I think that's one of my attractions to fiction. It's fluid. If it's good, it will stay fine over time. And I don't feel that I have any particular message. I just want to write authentic stories about people and the difficulties and the comedy they go through.
As we said earlier on, with the exception of one story, all the stories in this collection are based in a rural context. You're working in a novel. Is that also based in a rural context?
Yes, it's set on Mount Leinster.
Is that what you know?
Yes. Well, I'm a farmer's daughter. I was reared the youngest of six children in a place near Clonegal, and we had sheep and cattle and hens and shearing and all of that. and it's what I knew. It's how I learned to feel. I learned to feel on a farm. And how I learned to listen was on a farm. So I suppose, you know, people like the work of Heaney and McGahern, that all resonates with me because I can hear it. And it was a great place of sensation because my parents let me run wild to a certain extent. We were safe. We lived up the avenue, so we couldn't really join in, even though we were Catholics. And, of course, you wouldn't have the civilising force of people coming up the avenue to just call in because you didn't. So I was just left to run wild, and there was a wood all around the farm. And I suppose it wasn't exactly babes in the wood, but I suppose a lot of things go back to my introduction to sound. My introduction to sound was all in that house. I mean, I can still hear the churn, and I can still hear the yard brush on the concrete in the cowhouse, and the sound of the horse dipping his head to drink, and all of that, I think, comes out. And what strikes me about life now is that it's so noisy that we can't hear, and often there are several things going on at the same time. And it's one of the reasons why I live in very quiet places, because I really do want to listen.
But you mentioned McGahern and Heaney there. Is there something about us Irish people that we're not actually Irish writers unless we're sort of seeped in the rural tradition or in the... We seem to sort of like celebrate
not.
That.
Absolutely not. I mean, look at Joyce, look at Roddy Doyle, look at... There are any number of people who don't do it. There are city and rural writers in every country. I don't feel that I must write my stories in rural terms. It just happens to be where I was born and bred and reared and was introduced to sensation. I live in rural Ireland. So whether or not it is an Irish thing, I don't really understand the whole debate over Irish, to be an Irish writer. Are you an Irish writer? Do you consider yourself to be an Irish writer? For me, it's quite simple. I just feel like I was brought up an Irish girl and grew into an Irish woman on a farm, and this is how I write. And I write exactly what I please and will set it exactly where I want to. Otherwise, what's the point in being an artist if you're not going to do that and you don't have the nerve to do that and to say exactly what you want? But I think the debate over what belongs in Irish fiction or doesn't, or what's fitting or context, belongs to the critics. I don't feel that that's my job. I feel it's the critics' job to put that in context and bring it together and make some sense and meaning out of it. But mine is just to write stories.
Well, we're talking about critics. Does criticism actually help your craft or your work?
You mean the criticism in the newspapers? You mean the reviews?
Yes, or analysis, essays written about your work or reviews.
Well, I haven't read any essays written about my work. And I've read some reviews. Reviews, even if they're negative and they're well written, are helpful. But it's very difficult to get upset over a poorly written review.
So, you do read reviews then, do you?
Yes, I do.
You look forward to them?
Not exactly, no, but I don't wait for them either.
Another aspect of writing is being nominated for prizes and getting recognition through being awarded several prizes, as it has happened to you. Do you get really excited when somebody says you're nominated for the Rooney Prize or the Frank McManus or...
Yes, I do. I think it's wonderful. I think it's great that you sit in a room and maybe turn 50 pages into 10 and spend 6 months doing it and put it in a brown envelope and lick a stamp, and 3 months later somebody says, get your dress on and come up to wherever it is. I think it's wonderful. I want to be read. I want these stories to be read and to be enjoyed and to give people pleasure. And so when people ring me up and tell me to put my dress on, I'm extremely happy.
Claire Keegan, thanks very much for being with us on the 11th
Thank you.
Hour. And that was Claire Keegan talking to me earlier. Claire's new collection of short stories, Walk the Blue Fields is published by Faber and Faber.